Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Anna Marie Tendler sat in a beige room at a psychiatric hospital in upstate New York as the staff checked her in. She said she was happy, relieved to be there. She checked herself in for suicidal ideation, self-harm, and disordered eating. She was a woman in crisis, a woman who perhaps maybe felt a little crazy. In her new memoir, Men Have Called Her Crazy, Anna explores those weeks at the hospital alongside the relationships that shaped the woman she became, painting a vivid picture of what it means to break and to heal as a woman. Anna Marie Tendler, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And a quick warning before we begin our conversation, we're going to be discussing self-harm and suicidal ideation this hour. If you or someone you know is in crisis, call 988. The 988 Lifeline provides free and confidential support for people in distress. So, Anna, originally you started this as a photo book, not a memoir. When did you notice that it was shifting towards a novel?
It was actually my editor, Sean Manning, who got a hold of my proposal as a photo book, and he requested a meeting with me and said that there were some personal essays in the proposal, and he sort of said, like, this should be a memoir, you're a writer. I'll never forget, he said, the worst thing you can do for your writing is put it in between photographs where no one will read it. So I'm here to convince you to write a memoir. And I thought about it for a few days because that was a really daunting possibility to go down that road. But ultimately, and obviously, I decided to do it.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the title, Men Have Called Her Crazy. One of the reasons I love this is because you use her instead of me. And I think most women, by the time we get to a certain age, and you and I are very close in age, so by the time we get to a certain age, we've definitely dated someone who has called us crazy or someone who made us felt like we were going crazy.
Yeah, I wanted the title to have some distance from me, because I think that when people are called crazy or when we call people crazy, it's often done so behind their back. It's not necessarily to their face. I mean, maybe it happens to their face. We've also had it all happen to our face. But I really wanted to create this sort of distance and the idea that these conversations are happening kind of behind my back. And also, writing it in the third person, I think, allows the reader to put themselves in that place as well. And that was something that was really important to me.
Yeah, I think maybe this says more about me than everybody listening, but I feel we've all had that relationship where someone looked at you and was like, oh my God, why are you acting so crazy? And you're thinking, because of the way you're acting.
Yeah, we've all been there.
So how did the idea to explore those relationships? You go through a number of pivotal relationships in your teenage and early 20s. How did you decide you wanted to review those alongside your stay at the hospital?
At first when I started writing it, I wasn't exactly sure kind of what the crux of the book was going to be. And looking at like page one, a blank page one with the cursor blinking at me was incredibly daunting. So I just kind of jumped in and decided to write this really long essay. It was like 10,000 words about these three men that I dated when I was a teenager. And they ranged in age as well, from being close to my age to being well older than me. So I wrote that just as a jumping off point. And as I was writing it, I was like, oh, huh, I see a pattern here. And then kind of traced it throughout my life getting older. And I was like, ah, the pattern continues. Okay, there's something here to explore. And those chapters ended up being, that essay ended up being broken up into three different chapters, kind of in the middle of the book. But I just felt like I had a lot of anger to explore, but I wanted to push myself to explore it in a way that was constructive. And yeah, I felt throughout my life really kind of oppressed by male influence. And I knew that if I felt that way, a lot of other women felt that way, and it felt important to explore.
I have to say, you have this talent for reaching into readers and pressing on those scabbed over wounds of adolescent romance. Because the book made me remember my own college boyfriend who had this talent for making everything my fault, even his own infidelity. And those relationships, I think, are unfortunately somewhat universal.
For sure. They're universal and they're so pivotal too. I think that we women a lot of times, and of course there are exceptions to this, and in the book too there are problematic women as well. It's not that I think this is all on men, but I do think that women get put in a place a lot of time where we take on the blame of something, and can't sort of look at the objectivity. It's easier for us to sort of be like, oh yeah, this was definitely my fault and I overreacted. And yeah, and when that happens to us in our teen years, it becomes a hard pattern to break as you get older.
And, the beginning of the book opens very honestly and vividly about you're being checked into the psychiatric hospital in New York, and you're detailing why you're there. And it's very raw. It's in almost immediately and intensely intimate. You write that all I feel is anger, that I'm 35 and back to cutting myself, and that my life feels like a series of bad mistakes. It's just, I was reading the first chapter, like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. What made you want to start with this incredibly private moment?
I really wanted to drop the reader immediately in the action. I kind of that's what I like to read, and I think just purely from a storytelling standpoint, I wanted to trust the reader that they didn't need a lead in. They would get more information and backstory as they kept going, but kind of starting it with something that felt like a punch in the gut of being like, okay, let's go, like we're in it. I'm setting you up for what this is. And truly, like checking into the hospital was the scariest part of being in the hospital, because it was an experience I'd never had before. So it was incredibly destabilizing. It was really scary. You don't know what to expect. And yeah, my goal was to put the reader in that experience with me immediately.
I have to ask, how did you know that that was going to be the right choice for you? Because it has to be so difficult. And I think the decision to go seek that kind of help in a psychiatric hospital is also colored by the way those kinds of hospitals have been portrayed in media for generations, really.
Yeah, for sure. So it was actually my therapist at the time who had recommended that I seek inpatient treatment. And I was at a place in my life where I was open to anything. The situation really felt dire, and I really felt as though I was going to be in big trouble if I didn't get pretty intense care very quickly. So when it was suggested to me, I was sort of like, yeah, like anything. I'll try anything. But I will say, I entered into a private hospital. I don't have the experience of being in a state-funded hospital, which I think is a much different situation. And I was incredibly privileged to be able to enter into a state or a private hospital. But again, yeah, you watch movies about psychiatric hospitals and you wonder what you're getting yourself into.
Yeah, there's a
But
whole genre of horror movies about
oh yeah.
psychiatric hospitals.
Yes, and that was not my experience. I had a positive experience. However, it was also important to me to show the limitations of the hospital setting and the problems that I also found with the way that people are diagnosed, and just sort of how I think being a woman plays into modern psychology, which has been built around straight cis white men as the baseline for normal.
Yeah, we've talked on this show before about how there's lots of women now later in life being diagnosed on the autism spectrum because for so long the symptoms were white heterosexual male and it's not the same for women.
Yeah, and I found that too, I'm not, no spoilers, but in the last chapter of my book, I discuss reading the psychiatric report that was given to me, and there were things in it that made total sense that I really agreed with, and then there were other things that just could not have missed the mark more. And what I saw as they're looking at me as a woman in acute crisis and making broad judgments for what they're seeing in this moment. And yeah, I think it is really interesting seeing the way that women are being, I think, more properly diagnosed now, because man, to like either get a wrong diagnosis or to get a correct diagnosis, it can be life-changing.
Yeah, the book is deeply personal and raw, and I really appreciated how unfiltered it was. There are moments where you write in all caps, moments where there's these like sentence fragment stream of consciousness thoughts. How important was it to you to really, it felt like really trying to put us inside of your head in these moments?
Yeah, and as a person who suffers from anxiety, I wanted to capture in moments the duality of anxiety and rational thought and the way that they bump up against each other and the way that an idea can start as a rational thought and then sort of spiral into doom, I suppose.
Yeah, the thing I've always noticed is that it starts from an honest concern and then it becomes like an irreparable harm. It's a really nefarious way of taking good fear and making it bad.
Yeah, totally. And it gets away from you so quickly.
How was it hard to relive those memories, to go back to those places?
It wasn't actually. And I think that I would never have been able to write this book with any sort of clarity if I had not already processed what had happened in these moments. So, truthfully, the hardest chapter for me to write were chapters about my dog that passed away, because those things felt the most recent when I was writing them and very charged emotionally, while the other pieces I had really done a lot of reflection on them and felt like I had come out on the other side of them. So I could put myself back in the moments without feeling the emotional charge of them.
You had a TED talk where you discussed how women are seldom encouraged to meet their shadow selves. Can you describe what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think that all people have darkness and lightness. And I don't think that that darkness needs to be felt as bad or shameful. And, women are taught to be agreeable and nice and not angry. And I think that there are difficult emotions like anger that are actually like incredibly transformative if you know how to control them and work with them and channel them into something that is constructive instead of it kind of exploding out of you.
We're talking this hour with Anna Marie Tendler, the author of a new memoir, Men Have Called Her Crazy. Coming up, we'll continue to talk about the shadows cast by ourselves and the shadows cast upon us by others. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. On the last day of her psychiatric hospital stay, Anna Marie Tendler leaves. But a few moments later, she turns around and drives back. Her last day had ended with a Zoom call and a cryptic message from her therapist on the outside. Still with me is Anna Marie Tendler, the author of Men Have Called Her Crazy. I want to talk about your therapist for a moment, because oh my gosh, I had big feelings. So it's a woman that you've been seeing for several years. She, as you said, is the woman who encourages you to go seek inpatient care. And then it feels like it comes out of left field for me as a reader, this switch in personality. Did it feel the same for you?
Yes and no. There were warning signs, I think, leading up to this. But because she was the first longtime therapist I had ever had, and because for so many years it was a great relationship, she helped me immensely. And that cannot be discounted. I think that when the relationship started to rupture, I didn't want to see it. There were so many other things happening in my life that therapy felt like a real anchor point. And the thought of, in the midst of that, going, okay, there's something wrong here. I should seek new help. Just that felt completely overwhelming.
And I'm so glad that you included it in the story, because I think any relationship, whether it's a romantic relationship or a therapist, it can be hard to admit that it's not working any longer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of this book, and really what I wanted to get across both with men and with women, is that no one is all bad or all good. And there are times when I'm really mad at men, but then it's a male doctor who gives me this information about myself that changes my life and is amazing. And I have these really close relationships with women, but it's my female therapist who does a lot of damage. And just really being able to take a critical look at relationships and think, is this working for me?
Yeah, you talk about Dr. Phillips, that male doctor in the hospital who you say was able to understand you and talk to you in a way that didn't make you feel crazy. And I have to think that was so validating in that moment.
It was. I think it changed my life. He changed my life. And it was such a saving grace in that moment, especially because I felt so out of control emotionally, to have somebody speak to me and approach me not as someone who was quote unquote crazy, but, you know, he knew that I had studied psychology in undergrad. He wanted to talk to me about the results of my psychology testing. He knew that that would mean something to me. And it was a real gift to meet him and to be approached by him as an intelligent, capable, rational person who just happened to be in crisis at that moment.
One of the things he picks up on is this separation between your inner self and the way the world perceives you. That's going to be shocking to hear from somebody that you essentially just met.
Yes. And all of this was gleaned from a psychiatric test, which, you know, it's the test that you see in movies. It's the Rorschach test. And it was incredibly shocking to me that I really felt like this one single test got kind of to this, the kernel of who I was. And he was, I think part of that is just because he was an amazing interpreter of the results. And having somebody reflect that back to me at that time was so essential.
One of the things I found fascinating was they ask you to do math problems and these logic tests, and you're like, look, I'm bad at math. And the test shows that you're bad at math. But he says, you know, you got some of the really complicated problems correct. So I don't know that you're bad at it so much as that you get anxious and then you can't function.
Yeah, which was, it was hugely helpful to hear that. I mean, I did not get a single question on the math portion correct. So I still stand by that I'm bad at math, but there were portions that were puzzles and sequencing. And he described it as having an anxiety implosion, where the anxiety becomes so overwhelming that you're not going to be able to perform, that you can't perform. And it sort of doesn't matter how capable you are, the anxiety overrides any sort of intelligence that you can come to the test with.
It's test anxiety.
Exactly. And I am not a good test taker.
Yeah. And it's something that I think we've only started to talk about in terms of children and education really in the last decade or so. Like, I don't remember having a conversation about test anxiety when I was in school.
Yeah, I think it was really looked at as a measure of your blanket intelligence. And, you know, I did horrible on standardized testing. And then I went to college and graduate school where I didn't take any tests. Everything was writing papers, and I excelled.
I want to ask about that decision to turn back. So you have this uncomfortable, like, exit meeting. It's a Zoom call, because for context, this is all unfolding during the pandemic. This is in 2021, right as vaccinations are getting off the ground. And you decide to turn back
and extend your stay at the hospital. How did you, like, that's got to be such an incredibly difficult decision. Not only because, like, you had only planned on staying a week.
Yeah. I had had this outtake meeting that all of the doctors at the hospital were on and my therapist was on. And it was clear to me that the relationship with my therapist was not going to be able to continue. But I had plans to leave the hospital. The program I was in was a week, and I was just like, okay, I'm done. I gotta go home now. And I left, I checked out, and while I was driving, had a full panic attack, had to pull over, and ended up calling the hospital. And I was, you know, in tears, and they said to me, don't go back home. We don't think it's a good idea for you to go to an empty house. Come back here and we will figure out the next moves so that you are set up with support leaving here. And it was hard to make that phone call, but I think I knew in that moment that going home would have been disastrous.
I think it takes a lot of strength to make a decision like that.
Thank you.
I want to talk a little bit about the women in the book. So you talk about the women that, so you're living in a house with a couple other women, and they all are in for different things. A lot of them are struggling with addiction. You guys are all different ages, and you're only there a week, but you write so lovingly about these women that you meet. But it feels as though you form such deep connections in such a short period of time.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's such a singular experience, and you're thrown into this living situation with people that you never would have met otherwise. You know, the youngest girl was 18 and I was the oldest person. I was 36 at the time. And when would I ever live with an 18-year-old? And I was also there in the first 2 weeks of the new year in 2021, which is typically a very empty time for hospitals because people it's the holidays and people haven't checked in yet. And so there were five of us, including me, and it being such a small group of us, you know, you're just like thrown into this very intimate situation. You're eating with these people, you're watching TV with these people, you're going to group with these people. And I'm a very shy, introverted person. And when you're reading the book, a lot of what I'm struggling with is feeling like, oh no, or am I too quiet? Are these people going to like me? But I just liked them so much. They were such special people. And I really wanted to treat them with care and get across how interesting they were and thoughtful they were, while also being careful not to tell their story, because that was not my place.
Are you still in contact with any of them?
I'm not in contact with them. You know, some of them, like, we exchanged information, but I don't know where they are now. I hope the best for them. And if they read the book, it would mean so much to me for them to feel like they were represented accurately and with love.
I gotta ask, are their plants that you took home with you still alive?
They are very much still alive and thriving. I do not have a green thumb. I'm not good with plants, but the way I have dedicated myself to these plants, the jade plant is over a foot tall, as I write in the book. And yes, they're still with me. And it really feels like a link to those people. And I think of them fondly when I care for these plants.
For context, one of the group therapies was planting cuttings in baby plants. And so you sort of hoarded them together and took them home with you. And I guess that's where they've been ever since.
A lot of the people who leave the hospital enter into sober living facilities after, and you can't take anything with you except for your luggage. So one of them, asks me to take her plant. The other one just leaves her plant behind, and I end up taking them with me.
Yeah, that was one of the things. Like, as much as you're just living in this house with these other girls, there are these moments in the book where it becomes clear you're in a psychiatric hospital. And I don't just mean like the therapy and the group sessions. It's the you have to go get permission to get contact lens solution, or you're having period cramping and you need to go get permission to get Advil or Aleve. And so it's in those moments where you're like, oh, right, this is where we are.
Yeah, and you don't have a phone, you don't have a computer, you don't have any way to listen to music. You're there is a quite a restrictive quality to it. But
Yeah, you completely missed January 6, 2021.
yes. Yeah, I find out about it by overhearing some ho hospital staff listening to it unfolding on their iPhones, because we're also not really supposed to watch the news in the hospital. So that was quite a wild experience.
Yeah, in some ways, though, I think, like, I don't know, in my overscheduled, overcomplicated life, I'm like, it'd be nice if somebody like took my phone and my laptop and all of my stuff and made me like kind of hang out and do yoga for a week.
Oh yeah, that was amazing. I have to say, it really gave me perspective on the perils of our phones.
Yeah, I'm sure. Did you ever like reach for it instinctively throughout the week?
That's funny. I didn't, but what I found was without that noise of, social media and email and texting, that wow, my brain just started like overdrive. I felt like my observational qualities really heightened. I remember so much from when I was there, which made writing it much easier. I was like, oh, huh, there is really something to like taking a break from your phone.
Yeah, and you took notes while you were there. You wrote in a journal. Did you know at the time, like, it was going to become a book, or were you just sort of chronicling what you were doing?
No, absolutely not. I had no idea what I was going to do with my life when I left, which was part of the anxiety. I had was finishing grad school. I didn't have a job. It was incredibly scary. But I think because I didn't have a phone, because I didn't have a computer or music, to pass the time, I would write. And it was such a singular experience being there that I really wanted to remember it.
We're talking with Anna Marie Tendler this hour about her new memoir, Men Have Called Her Crazy. Our conversation will continue in just a moment on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour with the author of a new memoir, Men Have Called Her Crazy. And we've reached the point where Anna Marie Tendler is leaving a psychiatric hospital in upstate New York. She spent about 2 weeks there in January of 2021, and she's in a chapel, even though she's not religious, when she decides she never wants to be back in this kind of situation again. And Anna, I have to ask you, it sounds kind of like a religious experience in that chapel.
Yeah, it's funny. I am not a religious person. I wasn't going into it. I'm still not a religious person, but I'm a spiritual person, and this chapel, we went into it for this hope and healing talk that the chaplain gave, and it was just me and two of the other girls in the house, and it was the first time that the chapel had been opened since COVID. Everything had locked it down. So it was dusty and like the light was beautiful and it was coming in through the stained glass and you could see all the dust particles flying through the air. And I was so aware, like, I will never be here again. I may never see these people again. And I don't want to come back here. Not that it's a bad thing to seek help more than once if you need it. Like, but I really felt in that moment like I am going to put in whatever work I have to do to become so healthy and like sturdy in a way that this doesn't have to be part of my life again.
Your editor has compared the book to Jeanette McCurdy's I'm Glad My Mom Died. And for me personally, it reminded me of The Bell Jar, which is a novel that I love. Where do you see your book sitting on the shelf with others?
Well, first of all, thank you. Bell Jar is a classic. Yeah, that's interesting. I think that I don't think about the work that way, like in comparison to anything else. And when I started writing it, I didn't read any other memoirs, and I actually didn't really read that much while I was writing it because I didn't want to inadvertently pick up someone's tone or cadence. And I feel like when I take in writing or movies, like they really seep into me. And so it feels very singular to me, and I think I have trouble placing it within the literary world in that sort of way. But my hope is that people come to it as a literary work. And yeah, that it's approached as such.
Yeah, I would say if you like The Bell Jar, you're going to like this. It's got that same vibe to me. But you leave the hospital, you go back out into the quote unquote real world, although I don't know how real it was in the middle of a pandemic. And the first thing you have to do is go get your dog, Petunia, who is so important throughout the novel. At one point, when you're in the hospital and they ask you, what do you want to live for? You say the dog. And essentially just the dog.
Yes, she was such an important part of my life, and she was a dog that, as people who read the book will read, had many health issues and behavioral issues, and taking care of her provided a lot of purpose during a time where I didn't feel like I had a lot of purpose, and that was incredibly important during that time in my life.
And then at the end, you get to this heartbreaking moment where Petunia passes away. And I have to wonder, do you think you would have weathered her death had you not sought treatment earlier?
No, I think it would have been, I think it really would have broken me. And, I felt like she stayed with me until I would be okay without her. And I was in such a healthier place for coping with grief and with loss at that time. And so the day of her that she passed ended up feeling like this. It was so incredibly sad, but it was also this really beautiful day that I shared with her and with my mom. And yeah, I mean, she died while I was writing the book, and it was wild.
There's this moment where you say that, you know, you are spiritual and you do think that Petunia's soul is lingering in the house, and you're the one that makes the move to get her to go.
Yes, it was very clear to me in that moment that I needed to contact a healer to do a crossing over ceremony. I really didn't want her to be stuck in the liminal space between life and death. I was like, I want her to fully cross. And I did that on purpose, but was very struck by how I felt the next morning after. And I really didn't feel her in the house anymore. I really felt that she was gone, and having this moment of like, oh, like, damn, I wish I hadn't done that. But knowing that that was really what was best for her.
You know, in the years since your hospitalization, not only have you wrote this memoir, your photography and your art has really taken off. You've gone from being a woman that you describe as financially dependent upon your ex-husband to someone with their own money in their own home and three new cats, as I understand it. Is it strange to you to think, oh my gosh, how different life has become in the last 3 years?
Yes, it feels unbelievable. And yeah, to the point about like financial stability, I say this in the book, and it's something that I've really grappled with and had a lot of shame around, that I you know, I didn't come from money, but I was always financially stable because of my partners. I found myself in these relationships with men who out-earned me by a mile. And that was both, I had such a difficult relationship with it because it made me feel really bad about myself that I couldn't support myself. But at the same time, I think we forget sometimes that there is a long history of artists being supported by patrons. And it gave me the opportunity to get to a place where I could make it on my own. And there's an incredible amount of privilege in that. And I feel very thankful for that. But I also feel very proud of myself that I've gotten to a place where I'm like, yeah, I've got this.
Yeah, you write about a man in your youth who's wildly successful with an internet business, and you continue to date him even though you're in two completely different economic classes, mostly to prove that you can be there, that you can hang with the crowd who Hamptons on the weekends.
Yes, which readers of the book will find that I come to the realization that that is absolutely not worth my time. And I think that even that, you know, I had a real, like, I wanted to prove that sect that, like, you can't run me out because I work at a hair salon for $8 an hour. Like, I can hang with the best of you, even though I didn't even want to be there. But I really come to realize how flawed my logic is in that, and how, like, at the end of the day, I was only hurting myself by trying to fit into this world that I didn't even want to be a part of.
Yeah, there's this truly, like, I don't know, it just reminded me, I never had that exact experience, but, like, there's this moment where you are going to go out there, but you don't have money. And the guy's like, oh, you can be the maid. You can clean the house on the weekends, and that'll cover you living there. And I'm like, oh, like, you just want to grab 19-year-old Anna and be like, no, 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 no.
Yeah. And in that moment, I agree to it. And with hindsight, and with age, and with the wisdom that comes with age, I'm able to look at that situation and be like, Oh man, that was messed up on so many levels. You know, like taking a job away from a professional and trying to give it to your 20-year-old girlfriend. Like, what an undervaluing of the person who is already doing that job. And then also creating the situation where I am both a guest and the girlfriend, but a paid employee of everyone who's staying in the house. And I think that that whole thing just speaks to what it's like to be around people who have power by financial means and how truly detrimental it is.
You reference a lot of photography throughout the book, and you can find it on your Instagram. I went and looked for it. How did creating some of those images, which do not appear in the book, but you can go find them, how did they help process all of your experiences in the last couple of years?
Yeah, you know, writing is I like writing, I write better with things that are already processed. And photography, I feel like I can use as a means of processing because it's nonverbal. There's a freedom in that to kind of channel unprocessed emotion and the like kernels of rage. And I find that incredibly therapeutic, and I think that it's a constructive way of channeling difficult emotions. And I also found it incredibly helpful as a means of redirecting difficult emotions. And that's not to say like that you shouldn't sit with difficult emotion. I think that that is like first and foremost the most important thing. But if I felt really in crisis or really lost, setting up a photograph, thinking of a photograph, taking the photograph, this sort of multi-hour process of creating art, I found at the end of it, all of the really difficult emotions that I had been having before felt much more softened. I had kind of moved on from it, and those things had been channeled into something else that was creative, and they didn't come flooding back to me when I was finished working on the project.
How did you decide not to include them? You don't really include any photography, even though this started out as a photo book.
Yeah. And there were actually iterations where I thought like, oh, and there will be sections where I put photographs in them. And then I really wanted to keep it separate. There is a very small portion of one of the chapters of the book where I describe taking the very first self-portrait of that self-portrait series, which is called Rooms in the First House, and how I came to take that photo. But otherwise, I decided I wanted the book to live in a purely literary space and to keep the photos and the writing separate. And I also felt like there's something a little fun for people who would read it and hear this photograph described and then go and try and find it. And all of, you know, that work and that photo project lives on my website, and a lot of it is posted on my social media. And I see it as like a visual counterpart to the book that I hope that people will seek out for themselves.
I want to end with something that struck me. You talked about wanting to face adversity without destroying yourself. When did you know, or do you feel like you fulfilled that wish?
I absolutely do. I think, and to be honest, while I was writing this book, and even in the years leaving the hospital, my life has not gotten easier. I think I have, you know, there have been incredibly difficult things that I have dealt with in the years leaving the hospital. And losses, you know, losing Petunia. And I just going through those experiences and going through those losses and having constructive ways to deal with it and having, you know, days or with Petunia months where I felt that grief and I felt the depression of it, but I also was able to carry on with life and understand that that's what life is. Like, life is sitting with the good and the bad and being able to understand that things are not black and white. You can feel joy and pain concurrently. And yeah, I feel like I really have a handle on that now.
That was Anna Marie Tendler, author of Men Have Called Her Crazy. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
And thank you for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.